From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an Army Corps of Engineers report on Asian carp in the Great Lakes is 5 months overdue, held up by the Trump administration until there's a new head of the Corps. Great Lakes lawmakers push back.
My point to them has been, you haven't nominated anybody yet, and frankly, we're tired of waiting.
Some Michigan employers rethinking the value of drug testing.
In particular, with regard to marijuana, they're saying that, well, you know, if a guy uses marijuana on the weekend on a recreational basis, does that really mean that he's incapable of performing or that he presents a danger on Monday morning?
And theater talk.
Like, this could be on Broadway.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The rebellion in Detroit in the summer of 1967 has inspired all kinds of art, from music to novels to films. Add to that list a new play that chronicles the lives of women and girls who lived through the uprising.
When I was learning about the events of 67, I was really concerned by the lack of their voices in the published narrative, in the history books, but also in the newspaper articles that appeared at the time.
But first, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has completed a report looking into measures to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. That we know. But we don't know what's in the report because it's 5 months overdue. And that has members of Congress from the Great Lakes states searching for ways to force the Army Corps to release that overdue report. West Michigan Republican Congressman Bill Huizinga co-chairs the Great Lakes Task Force, and he is one of the lawmakers pushing to get this study released. Congressman, what is your understanding of why this report is 5 months overdue?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the last administration had sort of slow-walked this particular issue for years, getting studies done. You know, the work, the preliminary work that had been done. And at least the word from the current White House, the Trump White House, is that they are wanting to get the undersecretary in place to review the report before it's released publicly. My point to them has been, you haven't nominated anybody yet, and frankly, we're tired of waiting. So we think that it's overdue. It's been paid for. We know that there is important information that we need to have input from the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's just time to release the study.
I think for so many people in Michigan who look at Lake Michigan and the other Great Lakes, and then you see the videos, the YouTube videos of those Asian carp leaping out of the water, leaping into boats, and the thought that we've watched this coming, right? We've been watching this coming. And I bet you're hearing from constituents a lot who are worried about this.
They are. And I do hear about it. I had a, shall we say, a robust conversation with one of my colleagues from Illinois this morning about this. And he has a good chunk of the Mississippi and has a lot of those tributaries that are in there. And not that he was quite making the case that, hey, we're living with it, so don't worry about it too much. But I'm not sure that everybody outside of the Great Lakes Basin really has a full understanding of the devastation and the effects of this. And to his credit, my colleague did say to me, he said, look, we don't want you guys to live with this either. The question is are we doing enough? Mm-hmm. And we just have a difference of opinion on that. I don't think that we have done enough over the last decade to assure that these invasive species are not going to enter into the Great Lakes, and more importantly, into the tributaries that go into the Great Lakes.
And this report from the Army Corps of Engineers is an important tool in constructing a defense plan.
Well, it's options. The Army Corps was tasked with coming up with what the options are, and that was part of helping get that inserted in initially when we were looking to get this report done. And it isn't definitive, and it isn't like we have to pick option A, and that's the only thing that we're going to do, or option C, and that's the only thing we're going to do. We need to understand, though, what those options are and the menu of choices that we have. Because, look, at the end of the day, Cynthia, we need to do a couple of things. One, we need to protect the ecological balance here in the Great Lakes and in all of the water basins that lead to it. Two, we also need to protect the economic base that is part of the Great Lakes. The blue economy is huge. You know, some numbers, it's $9 billion a year. That is very important and vital to many coastal cities, whether it be on shipping, or whether it be recreational, we just need to find that balance. And in my mind, there's no reason why this report can't be released and shouldn't be released, just so that we can get this conversation to continue to move down the path that it needs to go.
And to that point, you've introduced some legislative arm twisting, if you will, an amendment that's attached to a spending bill on energy and water programs. What's in the amendment, Congressman?
Yeah, we're trying to use every vehicle that we can possibly do. And what this says is that it actually mirrors a Senate provision in this bill that says when this spending bill passes, then there is a time frame to release this study. And it's not a they can, it's a they shall. And we think that that's an important step. We're not sure whether it's going to be ruled in order or not, but I'd prefer to have the fight and find out and know what our venues are that we're going to be able to gain some additional success. I will say that we are making some, I believe, progress in the conversations. This has always been a bipartisan thing. Going back to the Obama administration, when there had been some cuts proposed to the GLRI, or in this administration where it had been proposed to wipe it out, there's always been a bipartisan, bicameral response that has been very supportive of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and all those efforts to deal with things like invasive species. So I think we are continuing to up the level of the dialogue. And frankly, I just want this White House and our House leadership and Senate leadership to know that we're very serious about this as a region, and we can't just kind of get put in a drawer and forgotten about.
It certainly seems that that fight is ongoing, and we've watched and we've seen as the funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Project was eliminated in the Trump budget, but then, as you say, kind of a bipartisan tag team effort got put back in.
Yeah, David Joyce from Ohio and Marcy Kaptur, David's the Republican and Marcy Kaptur is a Democrat. They worked hand in glove in appropriations on that particular issue. We had worked on the policy side as well. So, you know, I view as my role as one of the co-chairs of the Great Lakes Task Force, it's, again, trying to find those solutions and trying to find those balances. And at the end of the day, this particular study about what to do about Asian carp is a cornerstone to that.
What should concerned people do to support this push to get the study released?
Yeah, let our senators know, let our reps know that that's something you want. Get to the White House, encourage them to do that as well. There's those comments. Sometimes it feels like, well, I left a message, but what good does it do? They do tally those and track those, and it helps raise the profile. So, people need to know that we are going to continue to fight for that, and any encouragement that they can give, we deeply appreciate it.
West Michigan Congressman Bill Heisinger, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks, Cynthia.
Across Detroit, neighborhoods are trying to figure out what they can do to remake their community. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham, reporting for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, says one neighborhood is pinning hopes on something it still has that most of Detroit's other neighborhoods lost years ago.
There used to be dozens of movie theaters scattered across Detroit's neighborhoods. Nearly all of them have been closed and demolished. But there are a handful left, and one of them is the Alger. It's in the Morningside neighborhood on Detroit's east side. Paul Phillips is a board member of the Morningside Community Organization. He says the Alger was once central to the area.
The Alger was one of our cornerstone facilities here in the Morningside area. There's been a long history of the Alger Theater, and we've been hoping that it would be restored soon.
The Alger opened in 1935. With no TV, no internet, the movie theater was a major source of entertainment. Plus, it had air conditioning long before it was common in homes. But by the 1980s, the Alger fell on hard times. A nonprofit group formed in 1983, the Friends of the Alger Theater, bought the building a couple of years later. For more than three decades, the group has been slowly renovating the theater.
We are looking to activate a community center here on the corner of Warren and Outer Drive that serves these Eastside community members.
This is Friends of Alger board member Melissa Bunker.
It'll be available for their use. We will do programming as well as hopefully house different performing arts groups, could be educational groups. We are going to be doing all things including film.
So as I look around, there are parts of the theater that, look okay, and then there are other parts that look pretty damaged. I mean, there's a exposed pipes because of rotting plaster. It hasn't been painted for a while. Looks like a lot of work ahead of you.
What we've done thus far is work that you can't see. We've done asbestos remediation. It's expensive, it's not sexy, and no one can see it.
Now they're starting to work on the outside of the building. They want the surrounding neighborhoods to see that they're making progress. Paul Phillips says the residents are talking.
People are wondering what's getting ready to happen there, especially since they've been redoing the storefronts there. And then there's also been a buzz since last summer that there's going to be something happening on the rooftop. They've seen sketches, but no one has really seen what's going to be there. So there's excitement.
The rooftop will be the site of a patio. And we can tell you about one of the stores that's going in the street-level spaces, an ice cream parlor. Christopher Riley is renovating a storefront now.
I have my own creamery, Riley Craft Creamery, located here in Detroit, and I want to open up a retail location here at the Alger Theater.
Riley lives in the East English Village neighborhood adjacent to Morningside. He says opening in Midtown or Corktown might be a better business decision, but
Those neighborhoods don't need any help. I really kind of see like the seeds of a real turnaround and renaissance. But no one's going to move over here unless there's some cool services. And I'm really excited about this Alger project because I think this project's going to serve to really be like the anchor of these neighborhoods in the area, you know, to finally see some resurgence.
The added benefit is that the Alger Theater will have a tenant, a regular source of income to supplement the nonprofit's fundraising efforts. Melissa Bunker with Friends of Alger says the theater doesn't have to be perfect to be used. They had about a third of the seats fixed and cleaned for some events, including a movie. Bunker says the Alger can once again be the place to hold events and performances for the surrounding neighborhoods and the next-door Grosse Pointe suburbs.
We are in a very unique geographic position to be able to draw a very large market. And we can seat, when we get these seats up and going, you know, 600-700 people. Where can you do that? Nowhere.
There's optimism, but Bunker says what they really need are volunteers and money to bring the Alger back for Detroit's East Side. For the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Still to come, some Michigan employers rethinking the value of drug testing.
He put out the call for job applicants. Dozens responded, and about half were rejected because they couldn't pass a basic drug test.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is indeed in the grips of a drug abuse problem. At the same time, many Michigan companies are struggling to find workers for open positions. So what happens when these two problems collide? Reporter Chad Selweski explores this question in his story for Bridge Magazine. Chad, how severe is Michigan's drug abuse problem when you compare us to other states?
Well, overall, Michigan ranks number 10 in the country in terms of various categories in dealing with overdoses, deaths, usage, all those things. And on a national basis, just since I was wrapping up this story, there's some new evidence that's come forward that's pretty startling that shows that the U.S. had more deaths in 1 year than all the deaths combined for the Vietnam War. Drug-related deaths.
And at the same time, we hear a drumbeat of complaints from many employers throughout the state. We have openings. We can't get enough people to fill the openings. So how does this drug abuse problem play out in hiring and firing at these companies? Give us a couple of four instances from your story.
One factory owner that I learned about had some openings. He wanted to expand. He put out the call for job applicants. Dozens responded. And about half were rejected because they couldn't pass a basic drug test. Then I heard about another example in Detroit where there were a number of layoffs at a factory due to economic reasons. They had a recall of about 100 workers who had been basically furloughed, and every one of them failed the drug test when it came time to call them back to work.
And I can just imagine the frustration of a company owner hoping to up production and make the company stronger, and here everybody fails the company's drug screening. And at the same time, you talked to a drug director of an addiction treatment center in Traverse City who'd been kind of an informal survey of 30 companies in the North Country about drug testing employees. What did you find when you talked to him?
What he came up with is that only one in four of those companies did drug testing at all. And when he pushed a little further, the basic reason was they said, well, if we do drug testing, then it makes it tough for us to find workers to hire. And his reaction was, well, that's pretty dangerous, because if you're not drug testing and you have workers that are under the influence on the job, depending on the type of work, you could have some pretty serious injuries or accidents at the work site because of workers who are not completely sober.
Oh, risking everyone's safety. But it's interesting, because you did talk with some for your story who actually questioned the value of drug testing. Why is that?
Yeah, it was one of the most candid comments I got was from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. One of the officials there told me that a lot of employers are starting to question drug testing and its value. In particular, with regard to marijuana, they're saying that, well, you know, if a guy uses marijuana on the weekend on a recreational basis, does that really mean that he's incapable of performing or that he presents a danger on Monday morning? As far as opioids, a lot of them aren't testing for opioids because their attitude is, well, it's a prescription drug. It was administered by a doctor. That's sometimes questionable. And so their attitude is, well, it's none of our business. And frankly, some of these business representatives are pretty forward with the idea that, well, if we want to fill these positions, we need to rethink drug testing overall.
Because they're just afraid they wouldn't be able to do that. And of course, we know most companies, if you're an employee who fails a drug test, you're going to get fired. What did the experts and employers that you talked to think about that common response?
Well, the attitude among drug treatment specialists, experts, is that, you know, this has landed in the lap of employers, business owners, and they need to take a more broad view of this, a more enlightened view of this, and say, these are people with a medical condition. You need to be compassionate and help them get treatment, help them get better, and then let them come back onto the job. Unfortunately, some national surveys have shown that companies have the attitude of, well, if you have a drug problem, we don't want to have anything to do with you, or you have a, one of the phrases used in one survey was a moral failure. You have a moral failure if you don't pass our drug test, so we don't want you. But on the other hand, one thing that is concerning here is that it typically takes, especially opioids, it typically takes 4 to 6 weeks of treatment for any real change to happen. So if you're an employer and you're saying that, you know, I really feel for you, you have a problem, so go ahead and take 4 to 6 weeks off, the average employer is not that willing to do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Chad. I talked to one HR executive about this, and their company's policy is, if I'm the employee and I step forward and say, okay, boss, I have a drug problem, the company will grant me all the time I need to go through a treatment program, no different than someone who has had a heart attack and needs to recover. But if I refuse the drug test, or I flunk it, I am fired, because you got, you know, heavy equipment on the plant floor. You can't risk everyone's safety. And the point is, we can't pick and choose. It has to be equal for everyone.
Yeah. One thing I found, though, along those lines, is a lot of HR departments have that attitude. Open door policy. Come in. Tell us what your problem is. We'll help you get it fixed. But a lot of employees don't trust the HR department. It's kind of a strange situation where the HR department is saying, come to us and we'll help you. But a lot of these employees, according to the experts I talk to, have the attitude of, well, the HR guy is just going to go knock on the CEO's door and say, hey, John Smith just told me this, and you're going to immediately get fired. So there's a lot of distrust going on there within the workplace that kind of undermines this whole situation.
So, Chad, what might companies and their medical clinics and their physicians do that would be better for everyone, for workers and for the employers?
A lot of people in the substance abuse treatment business are very open in saying that they should be doing more to connect with employers, talk to employers, explain the opioid addiction, explain the situation so that they would be more open to a more flexible policy. For years, they've been told you need to have a drug-free workplace. That's a must. This goes all the way back to the federal government's war on drugs. In one category, there is a program that seems to have been working for quite some time now. The U.S. Department of Transportation, which regulates all kinds of called safety-sensitive jobs, they have a more caring and compassionate way of handling these things. This involves the areas where a worker high on drugs could really be a disaster. We're talking about trucking, railroads, airlines, pipelines, the shipping industry. The Department of Transportation policy there is, in these so-called safety-sensitive jobs, is that if you have a drug problem, we will help you get treatment. We'll help you get intensive treatment. And then you have a chance to save your job, avoid the whole experience of being unemployable, and you get the treatment, you stick to it, you get better, you can come back on the job.
Interesting thoughts. And boy, this isn't going anywhere, since we're a state that very well may wind up saying yes to recreational marijuana in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, that's another big issue, yeah.
Lots to think about. Well, Chad Selweski's story for Bridge Magazine can be found on the website, bridgemi.com. Chad was with us via Skype. Always great to talk with you, Chad. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Oh, what a beautiful morning.
Theater talk as we check in on professional theater productions all around the state. David Kiley from Encore Michigan is back with us again, and we're beginning with the world premiere of a one-act play at Tipping Point Theater in Northville.
That's right. It's a two-actor play that deals with the issue of teenage identity and the desire teens often have to try to be someone or something else than what they are. And the story centers on a British rocker and a 16-year-old fangirl who has a fanzine dedicated to the stage idol, and he's about to toss off this this false persona, this stage persona,
okay,
that she's been kind of dedicated to. It's really interesting. It's, as I say, it's a world premiere. I had a chance to speak briefly with the playwright, whose name is David Wells, and he talked a little bit about his inspiration for the story.
I was reading an article on David Bowie and when he put an end to the Ziggy Stardust character, and I hadn't been aware that he just did that without telling anybody. It was completely unexpected with no notice. And it got me thinking, you know, it would be really interesting if someone had found out ahead of time and wanted to stop him. That was the impetus for this story. And then, dramatically speaking, it makes sense if the person trying to stop him is arguably one of his biggest fans and most knowledgeable fans. So that's the jumping off point for young Americans.
That's interesting stuff. Wow, yeah. And this is just a one-act play, right?
It's one act, mm-hmm, meaning there's no intermission. Mm-hmm. It runs about an hour and 20 minutes.
Okay.
And I saw it over the weekend. And all I'll say is that it reminded me of some David Mamet plays. So I don't want to give away any spoilers, but but I think that's good praise for David to be compared with David Mamet.
Again, David Wells with a world premiere of this one-act play. Now we go to Marshall in the Great Escape Theater, which is bringing us a venerable play.
Yeah, this is a theater company that's been around, but they have new space, and they are doing The Miracle Worker, which is the story of Helen Keller and her teacher, Annie Sullivan. And we're very happy for them and the whole company. It's they've done a very nice job with it.
Over to West Michigan. First, the Mason Street Warehouse in Saugatuck. And you are, I can tell, real enthused about this one-man show called Fully Committed.
I have to say, yes. It's a show that's been around for a while, for about 16 or 17 years. It first debuted on Broadway in 1999. And I saw it, a revival of it on Broadway last year. The actor plays some 40 characters as he runs the reservation line at a hot, trendy restaurant in New York. He has so many different people to manage, impress, dismiss, look out for. It's very funny. And I have to say the actor, Francis Kelly, who's doing this work at Mason Street Warehouse, is every bit as strong as the Broadway production I saw.
That is.
And the set at Mason Street, like, this could be on Broadway.
That's
that good.
High praise. And I know as an audience member, I love nothing more than seeing a person being able to strut their stuff and show how versatile they are. Nicholas Nickleby, where everybody in the cast was 7, 8, 9 characters. I can't get enough of that.
It's a tour de force. He anybody who takes this role on is putting it all out there.
Now, a bit further up the Lake Michigan shoreline in Holland, the Hope Summer Repertory Company is bringing us some Arthur Miller.
Yeah, A View from the Bridge. It's not a show that gets done a lot, but it's a terrific play, actually. And it's timely in a way, even though it first came out in the 1950s. It's about a longshoreman named Eddie Carbone in Brooklyn, and his life changes when he agrees to harbor his undocumented immigrant cousins. So, and sort of all the drama all sort of rolls around that decision that he's made, and you know, his neighbors and people he works with and what they wind up thinking. And it's very timely, wouldn't you say?
When you think this thing opened in 1955 and here's 62 years later, if we can be talking about the relevance of undocumented immigrants and what's happening today. So very good. And then the Sunrise Side of the Mitten to Alpina's Thunder Bay Theater for a good old-fashioned evening of Rodgers and Hammerstein, their first collaboration that opened in 1943. And here's the title song sung by Hugh Jackman. This is from the 1998 London revival of Oklahoma.
When the wind comes sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain. Oklahoma, every night my honey lamb and I sit alone and talk and watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand. When we say, yo! We're only singing, God, to one fine Oklahoma, Oklahoma, okay.
Yep, Oklahoma. I visited this theater for the first time a few weeks ago to see the Addams Family.
Oh, yeah.
And this summer stock company did very well with that, and I'm planning on seeing Oklahoma this coming week. They have a standout actress in their summer company named Madison Dedman, who is from Howl, and she played Wednesday in Addams Family, and I understand she'll also be in this show as well. So if you're up on the east side of the Mitten, mm-hmm. Alpena is about 4 hours north of Detroit. And check out Thunder Bay Theater.
And since we last saw you, you've come out with the Michigan version of the Tonys.
That's right. Although sometimes I like to say that the Tonys are the Broadway version of the Wild Awards.
All right.
So we do, in Michigan, the critics from Encore Michigan and myself get together once a year. And we've been scoring all the shows that we've seen throughout the year. And we come up with a structure very similar to the Tonys. Mm-hmm. We saw over 240 openings last season. And our show, which is very entertaining, I have to say, we have some of the best performers in Michigan, the nominated performers, who will be performing some of the stuff that they're nominated for. It's at the Berman Center for Performing Arts in West Bloomfield on August 28th. The public is welcome as long as tickets hold out. And tickets are very reasonable. And you can either go to Encore Michigan and see our post about it, Or you can go to the Berman's website into their ticketing space and you can just buy the tickets online. But I promise if you're a theater buff and you are plugged into the theater community in Michigan, you will have a very enjoyable evening.
And so just to recap, Alpena's Thunder Bay Theater with Oklahoma, Hope Summer Repertory Company in Holland is doing Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge, Mason's Street Warehouse in Saugatuck with a one-man show called Fully Committed that David really says is Broadway caliber on every level, the Great Escape Theater in Marshall doing The Miracle Worker, and Tipping Point Theater in Northville has the world premiere of David Wells' play, Young Americans. Details on these plays and the Wild Awards happening August 28th at the Berman Center in West Bloomfield, all at the Encore Michigan website, encoremichigan.com. David Kiley, many thanks.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan.
We looked down 12th Street and all you seen was fire and smoke.
Oh, the motor city is burning.
Those shots are being fired on 12th Street.
Chaos. Chaos. Just everywhere. People everywhere.
I said, this can't be happening to my city.
The madness overtook everything.
Anything in the world that Johnny can do.
Through the ages, one very powerful way to bear witness to history is through drama, through theater. And that is certainly the case with a living history play titled After Life, based on oral histories of women and girls who lived through the 67 Detroit Rebellion. The play is conceived by Dr. Lisa Biggs, who's an assistant professor in theater and performance studies at Michigan State University. It's directed by Kristen Horton. And with us now is Lisa Biggs and one of the actors from Afterlife, actor-writer Deborah Chenault-Green. It's so good to have you both with us. Thank you for having us. Lisa, how did you conceive of this play?
You know, in 2013, I moved to Michigan from Chicago, south side of Chicago, and I wanted to learn a lot about Michigan history. So I realized pretty quickly, you know, the 67 Rebellion was a pivotal event in the state's history. But it also became clear to me that a lot of my students did not know what had happened, even though they're Michigan kids. So Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, where I teach, I had a chance to create a course that had units in which we could study the events of 67. And then being a theater artist about a year ago, I said, you know, these oral histories are amazing. And wouldn't it be fabulous if we could figure out a way of staging them? So I wrote for a grant, a couple of grants. The Knight Foundation was kind enough to fund us to be able to develop the piece in Detroit. So it started off as a personal research project and then became a project with students. And now there's this opportunity to rework and expand the piece in the 12th Street, the historic 12th Street community.
When you talk about staging that, how is it constructed? What is it we see?
Well, it is about an hour long, the play, and it takes place at the Joseph Walker Williams Recreation Center, which is at the corner of 12th and Euclid, or now Rosa Parks Boulevard. We do the play. It's an ensemble of nine. Deborah Chenault-Green is part of the ensemble. And we go back and forth. They play multiple roles. And we just move through one scene after another, monologues, poetry, song, dance, movement. So it's an interactive piece.
And I know, Deborah, and having you here, you are someone who remembers exactly what happened that week. You were, what, living at your aunt and uncle's house in summer 67?
Actually, I was at my aunt and uncle's house preparing for a birthday party for my mom later on that day.
And how old were you then?
I was 12 years old. Okay. So I was over there helping them get ready for the party. And my cousin and I, that night, that Saturday night, pulled the mattress off the bed because it was so hot. And we laid it on the porch, and that's where we fell asleep. And then we woke up to the noise. We just heard people screaming and hollering, things breaking. Later, about an hour later, we could see flames in the sky and smoke. It was chaos. And my other cousin, her older sister, she wasn't home. She had went missing. So they had to get up and go look for her. So it was a whole lot of moving around, a whole lot of chaos, fear, terrible fear, because we had no idea what was going on until later on that day.
And then how did it feel as that week went on?
It felt like we were in a war zone. It actually did, because our streets had never been invaded by armed men. You know, we had the police, yeah, but to see the tanks and the men with the rifles and the gear and everything at 12 years old, it was very frightening, you know, because we didn't know what was going to happen to us. We were afraid, you know, and even though the parents or my mother at the time tried to keep us some type of normalcy going on, in the daytime we would go out and play. She wouldn't be far away. But at night, it really became scary, because that's when we heard most of the gunfire. And that's when we first learned to hit the floor, you know. And some nights we spent all night on the floor.
You know, it strikes me, Lisa, as Deborah talks about her mother trying to keep a sense of normalcy under anything but normal, the importance of having this be women's voices. Tell us more about why you chose that point of view.
Well, women have been my greatest teachers time and time and time again. And when I was learning about the events of 67, I was really concerned by the lack of their voices in the published narrative. So in the history books, but also in the newspaper articles that appeared at the time. And part of that, you know, it's 1967, so it's pre-second wave feminism. And so women, of course, are working behind the scenes, mm-hmm. you know, in every arena that you can imagine, but yeah. News reporters would not have gone to them to ask their opinion. And unfortunately, it looks like at the time also historians were not so much interested in finding their opinions. And for myself, like I said, women have been my greatest teachers. And so I wanted to create a project in which we could listen to them and kind of address some of those gaps, mm-hmm. But also do more than kind of, you know, just add women's voices to the story. What I've really learned is that there's another perspective on life in the city that women can share, and they do. And that, insists on the inclusion of a gender analysis. So the role of women in the past, but also the women I've spoken with, they really, you know, have a long time commitment to the state of Michigan and to Detroit, and they are movers and shakers. Mm-hmm. And I think far too often women's contributions, their intellectual work, their knowledge has been overlooked. And so the hope is that the play can – it's not going to tell every story, but that it can create a space in which we might learn a little bit more about the past and then have a much larger conversation about women's contributions and their needs today.
We're talking about the play Afterlife, a living history play that is based on oral histories of women and girls who lived through – the 1967 Detroit Rebellion, conceived by Dr. Lisa Biggs of Michigan State University, who's here. And also one of the actors in the play is writer Deborah Chenault Green. And Deborah, you are going to, in the play, you perform one of your poems called 12th Street Pre-67 that really talk about a sense of place, gives us a very close and personal idea of what the neighborhood was like before that week of violence. Would you share that poem with us?
Of course, of course. Hopscotch, tag. Hide and go get it. Baseball in the alley, nowhere to hit it. Boys wearing holsters and guns, learning to shoot. Riding the popsicle bikes, pockets full of loot. Hot days, steamy nights. Mattress on the porch because it feels right. Did you hear James was stabbed? Almost pierced his heart. Down by Eli Wilson's cleaners. They say by Crazy Mart. Over some girl later seen with Flip. Hot dogs, Kool-Aid, potato chips. Block parties, swinging, dancing in the streets. To my girl, heat wave, just bopping to the beat. We interrupt your programming to bring you this important announcement. President Kennedy has been shot and killed. Penny Candy, Dotnetta's, Miss Harrison's Beauty Shop. Henry's Pig Feet in a Jar. Playing tag, Hot Tamale Man. Catch me if you can. Music heard all night long from the Calumet Bar, the innocence and beauty of 12th Street, pre-67, before the community died.
That is really powerful, yeah. Deborah. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
We hear so many different terms to describe what happened that week in July 67. We hear riot, uprising, rebellion. When you think of it, what words do you use and why?
When I think of it, I think of rebellion. And that's because I knew the situation pre-67. I knew of the incidences of the Big Four coming through the neighborhood and, you know, harassing the young black men and even young black women.
And the Big Four being?
The Big Four was a unit of the Detroit Police Department that rode four deep, two in the front, two in the back. And they would harass, they would just go through and harass and beat up and arrest for no reason all throughout the community. So I knew what was going on with that. I knew that everybody in the community basically knew that this couldn't go on. And we knew that something was boiling, you know, because it was an everyday thing, you know, that our men had to go through. And these were men, a lot of these men were men who served in Vietnam and who came back and had to face this type of thing, you know. So it was something that was brewing. And I think that we eventually rebelled against that.
Lisa, can you give us a taste of maybe a few of the other stories that we're going to be hearing when people come to see Afterlife?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Two in particular. There's stories that often don't get told. The story of Cynthia Scott, who was a black woman sex worker who was killed in July, actually, of 1963. So 4 years before 12th and Claremont went up in flames. And her murder at the hands of two white police officers became a rallying cry for many members of the community. Also, the story of the murder of another black woman sex worker, Vivian Williams, which happened about a week or 2 weeks before 12th Street, went up in flames. The reason that these stories are important is because there was a pervasive sense that there was no justice for the black community. And in general, Deborah's stories about seeing kids get, you know, mistreated by police, the Big Four. Oftentimes we think of that violence only being directed at men, but there was a deep sense of outrage that women were being mistreated. And what I love about the story, even though I mourn the loss of these two women's lives, is that, you know, it kind of ties together something that we see going on today with the Black Lives Matter organizing. Under that banner, you know, we understand that they mean all black lives. They mean women. They mean members of the LGBTQ community. They mean people with who are living with disabilities. They mean the incarcerated. They mean everybody. All Black Lives Matter. And that kind of sentiment undergirded and animated and fueled people's activism. So the night of July 23rd, 1967, when the police raided the party at 12th and Claremont, all that rage was behind the bricks and the bottles that were thrown.
I want to end by asking you, Deborah. You say mm-hmm. you call this, you know, you lived through this as a young girl, rebellion for mm-hmm. many reasons. Did that rebellion change anything?
In the community, you mean? No. I really don't think it did. We did get some more African American policemen, you know, and I'll say that was a good thing because I think that the police force should be representative of the community that you're in.
African-American mayors.
We've had African-American mm-hmm. mayors. But as far as that 12th Street area, nothing much changed. There are still buildings that were burned from the riot, still there. They've just started tearing down some. You know, that community, it was like they said, okay, they burned it, let them live in it. And so they built up around us. But the core, they're just coming in now to try and beautify the neighborhood and do different things with playgrounds and houses they're building now. But it's been 50 years.
So changing the name 12th Street to Rosa Parks Boulevard.
Right. Yeah. You know, you can change the name of something, but that doesn't change the place. That doesn't change the situations in that neighborhood. That just changes the name.
The play is called Afterlife. For more information, you can go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. It's being performed at the Joseph Walker Williams Recreation Center. We've got all the details up at michiganradio.org. Conceived by my guest, Dr. Lisa Biggs, and among the performers, actor and writer, Deborah Chenault Green. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dorothy Hall is one of the women who was right there during the uprising that summer of 67. Now she is 87 years old, and she has lived in the same house in the Boston Edison neighborhood for nearly 50 years. But in the summer of 1967, Dorothy Hall and her husband were living in an apartment building on the west side of Detroit near the epicenter of the disturbance. Here are some of her memories of that day.
We'd just come back from Expo 67 in Montreal that afternoon. And see, I saw these people milling around out on Dexter, and I thought they were having a parade. But then I looked, and there were people running by with half a cow on their shoulder. They broke into like a butcher shop, so it's frozen. You know how the legs are sticking out? And that must have been freezing cold on your shoulder. And what would you do with all that meat, you know? And all kinds of things. We're just breaking in every store because we had lovely pastry shops back in 67 and dime stores and all the convenience, you know, that you would need. They even broke into the Chinese laundry and just took stuff in brown packages. You don't even know what you got. And it was really bad because, see, we just came back. When you go on vacation, you get rid of all the stuff in your fridge and stuff. So there was no place to buy food. So we had friends that lived on Fisk, which is close there. So they went to the grocery store and bought stuff, and they came to the perimeter of the fray and passed the groceries over to us. That's how we got some food. Because I only had fancy things like smoked oysters and things like that in my freezer. You know, I didn't have regular food. I just looked out the window in amazement. I didn't go down there because I knew it wasn't right, and I didn't want to be in that because I don't steal from anybody, you know. But anyway, that's what was going on. So we just watched from the window, and then the National Guard came in after a while, and we had a curfew. You had to be off the street by 5 o'clock every night. And or else they would detain you. And there were some people in the apartment building that I lived in that died because they were out trying to see what's going on, and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they got shot. He wasn't doing anything. He was just standing observing, but he lost his life. He was like 24. I was afraid. Because the talk on the street was, you know, all those apartment buildings were owned by, like, Jewish people or something. And so these crazy people wanted to burn down the buildings because of the owner, you know what I mean? And so I told my husband that I wanted to move because I didn't want to be in all that stuff. But it took until we could get a house, and we got this house, and I've been here ever since, yeah. It just was a very troubling time because life changed. I don't feel that they had the right to tear up somebody's business. And from another perspective, they were like cutting off their nose to spite their face because they looted their establishments. So those people did not come back and open up their store again. They just moved away. And it's still the same way. Like, there's another lady and I, we walk together every morning around 8 o'clock, 7, 8 o'clock. We walk 3 times around the park. And when we're finished, we say, it would be so nice if we could go to breakfast somewhere. But there is no place within walking distance that you can get a decent breakfast. I don't consider a Coney Island a decent breakfast, you know. And so all those conveniences are gone. There's places there that never recovered, and this is 50 years later, you know? Well, so what did they accomplish?
April Van Buren and Sarah Swick produced this story. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.